Another home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom.
Ball game over. World Series.
The story of Sandy Amoros is a story of triumph and tragedy, of a man rising from the depths of poverty to the riches of fame and acclaim, only to return to the despair of destitution, homelessness, and loneliness. This is the story of a player who was known as the Cuban Comet. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball. Long before the Dallas Cowboys were known as America's team, the Brooklyn Dodgers won the loving and sympathetic hearts of baseball fans across the country. Brokers, bankers, and sundry corporate executives sporting pinstripes and starched shirts might root for General Motors, IBM, and the New York Yankees, but the steelworkers, cooks, carpenters, and mechanics who helped lay the cornerstone of a great nation lived and died with their beloved blue-collar bums, win or lose. The Dodgers were as human, accessible, inspiring, and exasperating as the Yanks were corporate, distant, dominant, and damnable. Wait till next year, was the fabled mantra for Brooklyn in the post-war. This team, blessed with a rich abundance of potential and promise, was at once the most storied and star-crossed of all big league franchises in the 1940s and 1950s. Well before the late arrival of Lady Luck in 1955, its familiar annual rallying cry had become something of a cruel hoax. By the time their perennial tormentors from the Bronx had counted up the winners' shares yet again, in 1953, the Dodgers were only one of three clubs remaining in the majors, along with the chronically inept Browns and routinely mediocre Phillies, never to have won a World Series. They lost in 1916 to the Red Sox of Babe Ruth, who set an all-time record by pitching his team to a 14-inning, 2-1 win, and again in 1920 against Cleveland, which whipped up on them with the only unassisted triple play in series history, the first Grand Slam in any fall classic, and the first postseason home run by a pitcher. Their next serious bid for a championship in 1941 was the beginning of a long and demoralizing accumulation of near misses, shattered dreams, and unanswered prayers. By spring training in 1955, the Dodgers were a rapidly aging, anxious squad of skilled but imperfect might-have-beens. Father Time was gaining ground in giant strides on this, the oldest team in the majors. The litany of blown chances in 41, 42, 46, 47, 49, 50, 51, and 52, and 53 weighed heavily on the mind and shoulders of Jackie Robinson, by now a gray and declining 36, as well as Captain Pee-wee Reese, whose 37th birthday was coming right up. Since 1940, Reese had been on the field in every inning of every ill-fated game in which his team was chased down and overtaken from behind, while within tantalizing reach of the promised land. But the boys of summer, seemingly motivated by a now-or-never mentality, left baseball's record books in tatters when they broke from the gate this year. They won their first 10 games. 2 weeks later, they were 22-2, with each loss coming by a single run. They clinched their eighth pennant on September 8th, the earliest date in history. They became the first wire-to-wire team in the big leagues since the fearsome Murderers Row, who else, claimed that distinction back in 1927. Another Subway Series opened at the stadium in late September, the sixth such matchup in 9 years. Battling to a 3-3 standoff, these familiar rivals headed for a classic and unforgettable finale on October 4th. Could this be next year? By the top of the sixth, Brooklyn's slender 2-0 lead had been in constant jeopardy. When George Shuba pinch hit for Don Zimmer, manager Walt Alston had to rearrange his defense heading into the home half of the inning. Nobody knew it then, but the world was seeing baseball history in the making. A fateful die, without which New York would surely walk away with its record 17th championship, had now been cast. The right-handed Jim Gilliam took Zimmer's spot in the infield, and Sandy Amoros, a southpaw, replaced Gilliam in left. The bottom of the sixth quickly produced possibly the most tense, dramatic, and eventful moment in World Series play. With two on, nobody out, and the Yankees trailing 2-0, Yogi Berra came to the plate. A left-hand power hitter, the three-time MVP was notorious for pulling the ball. A long bomb here, presumably to right, would sink the Dodgers. Knowing all this and following instructions, Amoro moved to within a few yards of dead center, about halfway between the fence and the infield. He was standing 60 yards off the foul line in left when Johnny Podres threw his best fastball, low and away. Contrary to the expectations of 62,000 ticket holders and the entire borough of Brooklyn, Berra punched the ball high into the air toward the line in left. Billy Martin, carrying the Yanks' first run, headed for third base. Gil McDougald, representing the tying run, sprinted at top speed toward second. He could see the play in the outfield perfectly as it developed in front of him. The rookie of the year back in 51 and a most competent student of the game, McDougald was certain there was no way a mortal being could dream of outrunning this ball. It headed toward the line, nearing the 301-foot marker, with Amoros racing across miles of open pasture in hot and seemingly hopeless pursuit. But Sandy Amoros wasn't known as the Cuban Comet for nothing, or for the mere purpose of alliteration. Easily the fastest player on his team, he would later say, "I don't know, I get it. I just run like hell and stick out my glove." He did that exactly, at the end of a long and speedy dash toward the distant foul line. In one spectacular moment, he was Jesse Owens in baseball cleats. The glove he mentioned was on his right hand. Thanks to blinding speed Gilliam didn't possess, and a lefty's maneuver Gilliam could not have made, the ball dropped out of the sky and into the Comet's welcoming mitt. A huge crowd stood stunned, and McDougal, on his way to third, was hung out to dry. With a perfect pirouette that only a left-hander could perform, Amoros fired a strike to Reese, yelling for the ball on the edge of the grass. The captain slingshot over to Gil Hodges, straining forward at first as an airborne McDougal started his desperate slide for the bag. This completed a breathtaking, game-saving, double play for these boys from Brooklyn. The mighty Bombers' ominous rally was suddenly over. Surviving additional jittery moments in the seventh and eighth inning, the Dodgers held on tight to win 2-0. They were in the visitors' clubhouse, celebrating Brooklyn's one and only world championship, when Yogi Berra and his incredulous, appreciative manager raced over to congratulate their extraordinary outfielder on what became one of the greatest defensive plays in World Series history. With that catch, Sandy Amoros would forever be known to baseball fans as the Cuban Comet. Like a comet, for one brief moment, Sandy Amoros brightened the baseball sky and then quickly faded from view. Edmundo Asasi Amoros was born in 1930 in Matanzas, 50 miles east of Havana, Cuba. He ascended from a rich Afro-Cuban heritage. A short ball player, listed at 5'7", 170 pounds, he had decent pop for a player of his size and stature. Edmundo was the youngest of six children born to Guillermo Amoros and Carita Asasi. Guillermo, who labored in the sugarcane fields, died when his little boy was just three. Carita supported her family by working in a textile mill. Edmundo attended school for 8 years, but he too began working in the mill at the age of 14. He was given the nickname Sandy because of his resemblance to champion boxer Sandy Sadler. The small but speedy youth had played baseball from an early age. He was already talented enough to hold his own with older players in Cuba. In 1947, when he was 17, the young black man also drew inspiration from his pioneering future teammate. The Dodgers held spring training in Havana that year, and Amoros later remarked, "When I see Jackie Robinson play in my country, I say if he can do it, I can do it too." In the baseball structure of Cuba before Castro, the cutoff point for the juveniles division was age 20. In 1949, age 19, Amoros won the national batting title at this level. This is significant because even well into his big league career, newspapers and Topps baseball cards indicated that he was born in 1932. Yet by 1951, Edmundo had turned pro at home. Clearly, the prospect shaved a couple years off his age for U.S. purposes. In early 1950, the young outfielder gained international exposure. From February 25th through March 12th, the 6th Central American and Caribbean Games took place in Guatemala City. Cuba won all 7 of its games in the 8-team baseball tournament. Led by Amoros, who hit 370 with 6 homers and 14 RBIs. That winter, 24 Cuban sports writers unanimously voted Amoros Rookie of the Year in the Cuban League. In 1951, Sandy Amoros was discovered by a young Dodgers scout named Al Campanis, who quickly signed the young Cuban to a Brooklyn Dodgers contract. That spring, Amoros made his minor league debut with the St. Paul Saints, one of Brooklyn's 2 AAA affiliates. In 129 games with the Saints, Amoros hit strongly, .337 batting average, 19 home runs, and 78 RBIs. That July, Andy High, the Dodgers' chief scout, said he was worthy of a $150,000 bonus, given what young American high schoolers were then receiving. A month later, on August 21, 1952, Sandy made his major league debut with the Dodgers. He batted .250 and 44 at-bats the rest of the way. He looked good at times, but he struggled against the breaking ball. For various reasons, Amoros spent the whole 1953 season with Brooklyn's other AAA team in Montreal. He won the International League's batting crown as well at .353 with 23 homers and 100 RBIs. Off the field, Sandy struggled. His English was limited to okay and steak. And, like all dark-skinned ballplayers, Sandy struggled under the heavy weight of Jim Crow laws when playing or traveling in the American South. Just after Christmas, 1954, Sandy married Magnalia Castro, his childhood sweetheart from Cuba. The couple would soon have a daughter. But the relationship between Sandy and his wife was turbulent, and eventually the marriage ended in divorce. While his career with the Brooklyn Dodgers stalled, Sandy's hitting was destroying Cuban League pitching during the Winter League. It was during the 1955 World Series, with Sandy playing a reserve role, that he made the catch that forever earned him the nickname the Cuban Comet. The catch led the Brooklyn Dodgers to their one and only world championship. The team would leave Brooklyn for Los Angeles just 2 years later. But that catch made Sandy an instant celebrity. He appeared on radio and television shows throughout the country. To Dodgers fans, he was the greatest hero on a team full of heroes. Brooklyn was a borough in euphoria. Amoros returned to Cuba as a national hero. He was a source of pride to Cubans, a World Series hero, a celebrity back home. Even as his career sputtered to an end, Amoros was beloved in Cuba. At the pinnacle of his life and baseball career, it appeared that Amoros' future was very bright. But tragically, from that moment on, his life would start to slowly slide downhill with a series of setbacks, bad break, and adversity. Sandy enjoyed his best big league season in 1956, hitting 16 homers and driving in 58 for Brooklyn in just 292 at-bats. In the World Series, however, he went cold, going just 1-for-19 in 6 games, with one crucial near miss. In the 5th inning of Don Larsen's perfect game, Sandy hooked a drive barely wide of the right field foul pole. Sandy would never reach his full potential with the Dodgers. Still, he remained a useful role player in 57, platooning with Gino Cimoli in left field. After 1957, Sandy saw little time in the majors. In March 1958, the Dodgers, who were then in Los Angeles, released him. He was a national icon in Cuba, a hero everywhere he went. Children idolized him, and in that baseball-crazy country, the world was on his shoulders. But then, the revolution happened, and things changed. In 1960, during a friendly pickup game among friends, Fidel Castro arrived, with camera crews on hand. He wanted to participate. "Before Castro showed up, we were going to have a good game," said Amoros. "When he came, we had to do differently. We were better players, so it wasn't fun anymore." In 1962, Castro approached him to be the manager of one of the teams in a newly created Cuban league that Castro made. There had been talk about Cuba getting an expansion major league team, but with the change in political climate, that would never happen. Amoros was still playing, and he wanted to continue doing that by going to Mexico City. "I told Castro I didn't know how to manage. I could play, so why would I want to manage?" Privately, Amoros didn't want to work for the government. Castro did not take his refusal lightly. He stripped him of his ranch, his car, all of his assets, and his cash. Amoros was detained in Cuba and not permitted to report for the 1962 Mexican League season. "Castro would not let me out," he said. Amoros' decision to reject Castro's offer cost him deeply. His celebrity was now underground. He and his family lived a life concealed from Cuban society. They could not go to restaurants, cabarets, or even movie theaters. Sandy and his family lived off the charity of extended family members. Broke and unable to feed his family, the borough of Brooklyn came calling for Sandy once more. The Brooklyn Catholic Charities Group stepped up and sponsored Sandy and his wife so they could obtain a visa to return to the United States in 1966. The Dodgers' Buzzy Bavazzi heard of Sandy's plight and consulted with team owner Walter O'Malley. It was agreed, and the Dodgers offered to place him on the 25-man roster for 1 week so that he could earn a small major league pension. He brought the lineup card to home plate for 1 week. Sandy was merely a shell of what he used to be physically. He weighed 140 pounds. Diabetes was affecting his deteriorating health. After a 9-day period in which he followed the Dodgers to Houston and Philadelphia, he returned to the Bronx, where he accepted a job at a Brooklyn TV and electronics store. Sandy's drinking grew worse, and it took a toll on his health and his marriage. His wife left him and took their child to Miami. Shortly thereafter, the store he was working at burned to the ground, and he was unemployed. Sandy, the hero of the 1955 World Series, was all alone. His drinking worsened, so did his health. His leg was very painful, but pride kept Sandy from letting anyone know. As his MLB pension started to arrive in 1977, Sandy moved to Tampa, Florida, and lived off the $450 check and menial jobs that he could find. He ignored his leg problem for 10 years, until it was impossible to ignore, but by then it was too late. He checked into a Tampa hospital in 1987. Gangrene and circulation issues forced doctors to amputate below the knee. In his last days, Sandy lived in need of assistance in a barren apartment. Eventually, he moved in with his daughter in Miami when pneumonia and the deteriorating diabetic condition made him completely unable to care for himself. Sandy died there on June 27, 1992. The man known as the Cuban Comet was 62 years old. Thank you for listening to this episode of Deadball. If you'd like to chat with like-minded baseball fans, please check out the Deadball discussion group on Facebook.
It's a base hit. It's a 1-0.
You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom
ball game over.